Good morning. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. I'm Dick Beeman. I welcome you this morning. The UUFM, as you know, is a welcoming congregation. We believe that each person is unique and that no person has to fit into a mold defined by any other person. We have no creed or dogma, but we do adhere to the seven UU principles which are printed on the back of your program, Order of Service. The seventh of these principles is that we respect the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. And in the context of today's program, that principle has special reference to valuing, respecting, and caring for old people, which is our theme today. We especially welcome visitors. As I take a quick scan, I don't see any, but are there any visitors that would like to raise their hand or introduce themselves? Okay. No one has handed me any announcements, but the announcement? Oh, I've just been handed an announcement. The other announcements are in your inside page in your order of service. Ann Marchin is hosting a going away wake for the move of Steve Mullen, Marilyn Caldwell, Tuesday, September 25th, next Tuesday. The event starts at 5 p.m. with a wine and cheese party. We will whine about them leaving and drown our sorrows in wine and get cheesy sentimental. This will be followed by a going away party at 7 p.m. Both events will be at Ann Marchin's house, 3600 Monarch Circle. So Tuesday, this next Tuesday, day after tomorrow. Okay. The lighting of the chalice. The chalice flame today will represent the flame that continues to give light even in our old age, although that flame might give less heat. Would you please stand as you are able, and we will sing number 1046 in your little blue hymnal, the little blue one.
Thank you.
Do we have any joys and concerns? Anne has one there.
Shirley Hillbronk, and we have a joy this morning. We have two new members. Fred Newton, would you stand up, Fred? Fred Reynolds. And Jane Pelletier is signing this morning. Would you stand up, Jane?
Ann Cowan, I just wanted to bring greetings from Betty Banner. She's been in the hospital after a little complication from a heart cath, and she is home doing better and says by next week she should be well enough to be here.
Larry Weaver, it was a joy to sing an old hymn that I certainly learned in the Methodist Church, but it's part of our universalist heritage. Everybody's going to heaven was the universalist picture, and this is a song about that.
Any others? Judy has one.
A lot of you wanted the five wishes and the version that Kansas approves of, and I have had to order more, and so you will all get them next week.
Marilla Caldwell, just want to say what a joy it's been to belong to this group. I've never felt more comfortable anywhere in my life. And I'm really going to miss you. And we have tricked Ann Marchand into keeping a lot of stuff that we can't take, telling her we will be back next spring to get it. So we'll get to see you then.
Any others? Okay, if the kids will come forward, Chris Renner has a story.
How many of you started school last month? Everybody started school again last month, right?
We have a technical difficulty here.
Okay. Was the first day of school sort of scary? No, you liked it? Leaving? All right. There could be some things said here, but anyway. So, you liked going to school on the first day? You weren't afraid at all? Did you miss your mom? Didn't miss your mom. Okay. Well, this story is about going to school, and I know we started a couple weeks ago, but I thought it would fit in really well today with what the seniors are going to talk about, the big people, when you guys go to class. We're going to talk about taking care of our elders. And this here is a story about a little raccoon. Now, what do you guys know about raccoons? Do they come out during the day? They're nocturnal, okay? So he goes to school at night, okay, because they are active during the night. Chester Raccoon stood at the edge of the forest and cried. "I don't want to go to school," he told his mother. "I want to stay home with you. I want to play with my friends, and I want to play with my toys and read my books and swing on my swing. Please, please, please let me stay home." Mrs. Raccoon looked at took Chester by the hand and nuzzled him on his ear. "Sometimes we have to do things we don't want to do," she told him gently, "even if they seem strange and scary at first. But you will love school once you start. See Chester and the bird? You'll make new friends and play with new toys, read new books and swing on new swings. Besides, she said, I know a wonderful secret that will make your nights at school seem as warm and cozy as your days at home. Chester wiped away a tear and looked interested and said, what secret? What kind of secret is there? A very old secret, said Mrs. Raccoon. I learned it from my mother, and she learned it from her mother, and her mother learned it from her mother. It's called the kissing hand. The kissing hand, said Chester. What's that? I'll show you, said Mrs. Raccoon. She took Chester's left hand and spread open wide his fingers and knelt down, and right in the middle of the palm, she kissed it. Chester felt his mother's kiss go up his arm and across his shoulder and right into his heart. He felt really special. Mrs. Raccoon smiled. Now, she told Chester, whenever you feel lonely and need a little loving from home, all you have to do is press your hand against your cheek and think, Mommy loves me. Mommy loves you. And that very kiss will jump off from your palm onto your face and give you toasty, warm thoughts. She took Chester's hand and carefully wrapped his fingers around it and to kiss. Now, do be careful not to lose it, she teased. But don't worry. When you open up your hand and wash your food or wash your hand, I promise the kiss will stick to your hand. Chester loved his kissing hand. Isn't that cute, Chester? Now he knew his mother's love would go with him wherever he went, even to school. That night, Chester stood in front of his school and looked thoughtful. Suddenly, he turned to his mother and said, with a grin, give me your hand. And she gave him his hand. And Chester took his mother's hand and in his own and unfolded her fingers, very familiar fingers to Chester, into a fan, and next he leaned out forward and kissed her hand right in the center of her palm. Now you have a kissing hand too, he told her, and with a gentle goodbye and I love you, Chester turned and danced away to his new school. Mrs. Raccoon watched Chester scamper across the tree limb and enter the school as the hoot of an owl rang in the new school year. She pressed her left hand just to her face and to her cheek and smiled. The warmth of Chester's kiss felt her heart with special words. Chester loves you, it sang. Chester loves you. There's Chester at school. All right. Go now in peace. Go now in peace. May the Spirit of love surround you everywhere you may go.
After the offertory, we're going to get a 21st century vision of elder care from Garrett Lee. But right now, we're going to get a 1st century BC vision of old age from Cicero, a Roman philosopher. In this dialogue called On Old Age, he is speaking through the character of Cato the Elder, who is 83 years old, and he's speaking to two of his disciples. So, on old age. I find that there are four reasons for the prognosis of a dismal and troubled old age. First, that in old age the mind withdraws from active engagement. Second, that old age enfeebles the body. Third, that it deprives us of physical pleasures. Fourth, that it is one step removed from death. Let us examine the force and justice of each of these reasons in turn. The first claim is that old age brings intellectual diminishment and withdraws us from active employments. No doubt memory may dwindle in old age unless you keep it in practice. I have never heard of any old man forgetting where he'd hidden his money. Sophocles composed tragedies into extreme old age, ostensibly even to the neglect of his business affairs. His own sons hauled him into court to deprive him of autonomy over his affairs on the grounds of imbecility. The old poet thereupon read aloud to the judges his play, Oedipus at Colonus, which he had just composed, and queried them, "Does that poem strike you as being the work of an imbecile?" After the reading, he was acquitted by the jury. Just as the aged, if they are wise, take delight in the society of those youths who are endowed with an agile wit, so also do the young find pleasure in the wisdom of their elders, by whose precepts they are guided to the path of virtue and excellence. I do not perceive that you find my society less pleasant than I do yours. Old age is a busy time, neither listless nor sluggish. One is always doing and attempting things. In my own case, it was only as an old man that I became acquainted with Greek literature. The second claim is that old age enfeebles the body. I do not miss the bodily strength of a young man now that I am old, any more than I miss the strength of a bull or an elephant when I was a young man. Which of the two would you prefer as your endowment? The physical powers of Milo, who could hoist an ox onto his shoulders, or the intellectual powers of Pythagoras, who could perceive the harmonies of creation? Enjoy the blessing of strength while you have it, and don't bewail it when it is gone, unless you believe that youth should lament the loss of infancy, or manhood the passing of adolescence. The course of life is fixed, and nature allows it to proceed only once and in one direction only. And each part of our life has its special seasoning, so that the delicacy of childhood, the impetuosity of youth, the soberness of maturity, the wisdom of old age, each bears some of nature's fruit, which must be secured in its proper season. And yet, I do admire a youth who harbors some quality of the old, just as I admire the aged one who retains some essence of youth. Such a one may become old in body, but will never senesce in mind or thought. The intellect becomes more nimble through mental exercise. I myself am now engaged in composing the seventh volume of my treatise on the antiquities. And in order to exercise my memory, I follow the practice of the Pythagoreans. I go over in my mind each evening all that I have said, heard, or done in the course of each day. These are the exercises of the intellect, the training grounds of the mind. While I perform these labors, I don't much feel the loss of bodily strength. I act as counsel for my friends. I frequently attend the Senate and propose subjects for discussion, prepared after deep and long reflection. And these I support by my intellectual, not my physical forces. Whoever continues to pursue his lifelong studies and labors does not perceive when old age gradually creeps upon him. And if I were not strong enough to do these things, I would still enjoy my sofa, taking delight in reflecting on the deeds I no longer had strength to accomplish. The third charge against old age is that it deprives us of sensual pleasures. What a splendid service old age renders if it liberates us from that most savage defect of youth. Nature has imposed no more deadly curse on humankind than carnal pleasure, which rouses our appetites beyond all prudence or restraint. It is a fruitful source of treason, deception, revolution. In fact, there is no crime, no evil deed to which the urge for sensual pleasure does not impel us. It is a blessing that the soul, having survived its youthful campaigns of lust and ambition, strife, rivalry, and enmity, should live in its own thoughts and should dwell apart. Indeed, if the soul has any accumulated store of the food of study and philosophy, nothing can be pleasanter than a quiet and contemplative old age. But, you will say, old age deprives us of the pleasure of the table and the wine cup. Well then, it also frees us from headache, disordered digestion, broken sleep. And although old age must abstain from extravagant banquets, it may still find delight in temperate repasts. In my youth, I used to dine with my companions with a certain ardor appropriate to my age. But I was never prone to measure my youthful enjoyment of these banquets by the physical pleasures they gave, more than by the gathering and conversation of friends. Our forefathers did well to designate the reclining of friends at feasts as a convivium, a living together, implying a community of enjoyment, not a drinking together or an eating together. Need I mention the planting and cultivation of vines? In gardening, I find incredible delight, not one whit held in check by old age. I can never have too much of the pleasure of cultivating plants, of the natural force which all things propagated from the earth possess, from that tiny grain in a fig or the grape stone in a grape. Tendrils creep on, spreading themselves in intricate and wild profusion. Can anything be richer in product or more beautiful to contemplate? There still looms the fourth and last charge, which more than any other seems designed to fill old age with apprehension and anxiety, the nearness of death, which, it must be granted, cannot be far away. But wretched indeed is the old one who has not learned in the course of so long a life that death is not a thing to be feared. If it utterly annihilates the soul, then death becomes negligible. If instead it brings immortality, then it is even to be desired. Surely no third alternative can be found. Why then should I be afraid of death if it brings at the very least an end to the possibility of unhappiness, or better yet, an eternity of happiness? To my mind, nothing that must come to an end can seem lengthy, for when that end approaches, then all the past has slipped away. Nothing remains but the fruit of good and virtuous deeds. Hours and days, months and years depart, the past returns no more, the future cannot be known. Whatever time each is granted for living, with that he is bound to be content. What can be more in accordance with nature than for the old to die? Green apples may be plucked with difficulty from the tree, but when ripe and mellow, fall of themselves. So it is that violence takes life from the young, while ripeness takes it from the old. This ripeness is so delightful to me that as I approach the end of life, I feel like a mariner in sight of land at last, about to anchor in his home port after a long voyage. My old age sits lightly upon me. It is not only not oppressive, but is even delightful. Even if I am wrong in believing in the immortality of the human soul, I am glad to be wrong. Nor will I allow this belief, which gives me so much pleasure, to be wrested from me as long as I live. But if, when I die, sensation and spirit die with me, as a few insignificant philosophers have imagined, I will at least have no fear that these dead philosophers will deride my error. Even if we are not to be immortal, one should nevertheless wish to have one's life end at its proper time. For nature puts a limit to living, just as to everything else. Old age is the final scene in life's drama, from which we should wish to escape when it grows wearisome and we have had our fill. Such are my views on old age. May you attain it, and thus be able to prove by your own experience the truth of my words. Garrett Lee is the Associate of Executive Director at Meadowlark Hills Retirement Community, and we're very glad to welcome him today and have him give us his thoughts on caring for the aging in a rapidly aging population. Thank you, Garrett.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay? All right. I'll try to stay behind the podium. I tend to wander a little bit when I'm speaking, and I'm going to set my phone up here. I can tend to get long-winded on talking things about that I'm passionate about, so I'll set that there. And I appreciated Christopher's story. My dog and I have been chasing three raccoons off my porch for about the past month and a half, and they are pesky little things. Well, as Dick said, my name is Garrett, and I work for Meadowlark Hills Retirement Community. I see a lot of familiar faces out in the crowd today, so that's comforting. And I always appreciate when I'm listening to people just knowing who they are. So if you don't mind, I'd like to just offer you a brief sort of explanation of why I'm here and who I am. So I'm a Okie from Muskogee, and if you're familiar with the Merle Haggard version of that song, I'm from Muskogee, Oklahoma. I moved up here about a year and a half ago with my wife and daughter, and to work at Meadowlark Hills. And I came to know Meadowlark Hills because my wife's grandparents lived there. Her grandfather passed away there two or three years ago, and her grandmother still lives there with us in, in one of our long-term care households. And from the first time that I came to Meadowlark, I recognized it to be a very, just a very unique spiritual place. One that you could, it was so much different than the other nursing homes that I had been to. And I'm very careful when I call it a nursing home. And there was just something about it that drew me to it. And so I was in graduate school at the time, and I went to Missouri State University. So if you've been keeping up with K-State football, you've heard that name a little bit lately, and you ran all over my alma mater there. So, but I did come from over there, and the person that I was, that's now our CEO, was the administrator at the time, and we started sort of a dialogue. I was able to come and meet with him, and I was studying respite care at the time, which is a form of relief care for those that are caring for a loved one maybe who needs a higher level of care. And so I was able to interview him. We started a dialogue over a few years, and then I ended up moving up here to help serve over there at Meadowlark Hills. So really happy to be here today. When Dick and I were talking about coming and doing a presentation here, you know, there's so much in healthcare these days that we could discuss and make each other aware of. And especially in long-term care, there are a lot of things. I was contemplating on what to do with my time with you, and I landed on something that many of you in here are going to be familiar with because you've heard me talk about it before. But this idea that Meadowlark Hills has adopted, but the long-term care industry, it's spreading like wildfire, and it's this idea of culture change. And before I get too much into it, I want to set the stage, if you don't mind, with a scenario. Culture change. Excuse me. Yeah, and thanks, Ruth. And I want to set the stage just briefly with providing a narrative for you. And let me start off by saying that we at Meadowlark Hills, we're a CCRC, which stands for a Continuing Care Retirement Community. And many of you know what that is. But basically, what it means is, as opposed to a standalone, say, nursing home, we have every level of care available, including independent living. So some folks, it's where they live and they're not receiving any sort of care. But I want to make that piece clear that in the when we talk about long-term care, we can talk about all kinds of different levels of care that exist out in the industry. But I want to read this opening scenario, set the tone a little bit, and what this scenario describes. It's from the perspective of a patient in a nursing home who lives with some level of dementia, and it's their account of how they're being cared for, and I think this is important for us to note what the reality is for some people. So let me just read this. This is called an institutional morning. This morning, a strange man was in my bedroom when I woke up. I told him to go away, but he said it was time to get up. The light was so bright and he was in such a hurry. He asked what I wanted to wear, but before I could answer, he took a sweater out of my closet. I said I didn't want to wear a sweater, but he just said we had to hurry up and get to breakfast. Why were we having breakfast at 6 o'clock at night when it was dark outside? I started to cry. Finally, he stopped and looked at me and said, "Listen, we just have to go to breakfast now. It'll be just fine." He took me out of my room in my wheelchair, and then he left. A woman came up to me and said, "What are you doing here in the hallway? Where is John?" I said, "I didn't know, and why couldn't I just go back to my room?" Then the man came back, and he and the woman stood on either side of me and talked for a while. I think they were laughing at me. I wanted to go to sleep, but there was so much noise and so many people. Then another woman came in and wheeled me up to a table. I wanted to use the restroom, but the woman didn't understand. She said, "You just did that," but I needed to go. Nobody listens to me. Instead, she brought me some orange juice. I tried to tell her I wanted to go to the restroom, but she walked away. The man next to me was shaking his head. I don't know why he does that. I don't like all that movement. Someone brought me fried eggs and some cold white toast. I like my eggs scrambled, but the girl just smiled at me when I said that. I just want to go back to my room and go to bed. And you know, the reason I share that with you is not to bring you down at all, but to really make you aware that this is the reality for a lot of the long-term care world in our nation. And in fact, about 95% of the long-term care industry is still operating in that institutional model that I just read about. And so the things that are happening in those institutions, and it's no fault of the staff there, it's because our culture has been the way that it is for so long, is such that an individual will wake up when it's time to wake up, will have scheduled medication routines, will have scheduled eating times, will be told, you know, when visitors can come see them or when it's time to go to bed. And when I mentioned the word culture change earlier, what I'm really talking about is a method of caring for our elderly that is person first, what we call person first, and or person-centered care, as the rest of the industry calls it. And as opposed to how we have all, what we're all accustomed to in how our elderly are cared for, if you think back, and I don't claim to be a historian, and I know there's a few in the room that are history buffs here, but a number of years ago, not very long ago, but even further back then, a couple, 200 or 300 years ago, the culture was such that the elderly were revered. They were considered wise. They were very respected, and it would be virtually unheard of for their loved ones or their family members or those that they were close to place them somewhere where people who they didn't know, people who the family didn't know, were taking care of them. So you fast forward into the civilization that we are in now, where that is the norm. That's what happens. Our busy schedules, our busy lives, are the excuse that we give that we're not going to care for our parents and our grandparents by ourselves, that we're going to have them in a place where they can get around the clock care. And that is an excellent concept that they could get that type of care. But because of how business is, there's some efficiencies that have been deemed appropriate in the long-term care industry. There's some ways of doing things. We're so concerned all the time about staffing ratios and different things of that nature that we end up, and I heard this term used a while back and it alarmed me, but we end up what in society kind of deems as warehousing of our elderly. And when I heard that, I mean, and you could probably, it just kind of rips your heart right out of your chest there when you hear that, because what that essentially, it paints a picture for you. What warehousing of the elderly means to me is that we herd a group of people in somewhere, we put them in specific areas or on the shelf in which there's other people like them, and then we care for that individual in the exact same way that the next person is cared for. And we do it in as a group, and we do it in the most efficient manner that's the least cost inhibiting fashion. And that's really alarming. Fortunately, the healthcare world, the Department of Health and Human Services, has recognized that is the reality, that trend is existing. Those that have some stake in long-term care industry have recognized that, and there's groups out there now, and we partner with them that help to educate society, but they help to educate the rest of the healthcare world on what is happening out there and how they can combat that. And I want to spend a few minutes talking about how do we in the long-term care industry address that? What are the things that we're doing to help care for our elderly in better ways and more person-centered ways? And then what are the good things for us in the general society to know about this and to be aware of so that we can make sure we're contributing to those efforts as well? And the first thing I want to mention is this idea, and many of you are aware, but you're seeing home health agencies pop up all over the place, right? In fact, I can name probably six here locally. And that's a really good thing. And the idea about home health is that those individuals who want to take advantage of a service like that, those elderly that want to take advantage of that, in theory would be able to remain in their homes longer and remain independent for longer, okay? So it depends on the home health agency's ability to meet higher level demand in the home, so whatever the level of care is that that person's requiring. But that's the trend that's happening nationwide now, is that home health agencies are popping up all over the place. And I suspect, and many healthcare professionals suspect, that in the growing years, that trend will continue. And, somebody earlier mentioned, or the program talks about a rapidly growing elderly population. And it's no secret that my parents' generation, the baby boomers' generation, is coming up into the golden years, and that's going to be a great influx of folks that are going to need some level of care. So I see the trend in nursing homes continuing to increase, which in turn, in theory, could start decreasing the amount of long-term care places that are available and assisted living places that are available. So that's a trend that's happening. But I'm going to get into this more person-first concept and how do we more adequately and better, more respectfully care for the elderly. But home health is one way in which we do that. We bring the people that know how to do that to the person instead of bringing the person to them. A couple other just things to be aware of, and if you're interested in this type of thing at all, I can provide you resources and ways in which you can go research this on your own. But the federal government has also recognized that the way that we care for our elderly is not the greatest, and so the federal and state governments are doing things right now. One of them in particular is known as PACE. It's P-A-C-E. It stands for Programs for All-Inclusive Care of the Elderly. And this is a great tie-in to the meat and potatoes that I want to get into about this. But PACE is basically, so there's some technical components of it. It's a program. It's actually been around for about 25 years. But it's just in the last 10 years or so really gained widespread adoption from the healthcare community. And there's close to about 100 PACE sites in the nation. And the technical side of it is that it's a program that serves what we call dual eligibles, which are those who are eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid services. But the idea, though, is that a person is taken. A person can have a team of caregivers. It's called an IDT team, an interdisciplinary team, and on this team are people that. There's doctors on this team. There's dietitians on this team. There's social workers. There may be a chaplain on this team to make sure spiritual needs are getting taken care of. There's a transportation driver on this team. There's social service designees and so on and so forth. And this program, this person that is the PACE provider that's providing all these services for this person assumes all the financial risk, assumes all of the risk for clinical outcomes and quality outcomes, so making sure that this person is very well cared for and so on. But the idea is that every part of that person's life can be addressed and they don't have to worry about it. It's somebody else's job, but that somebody else, that team, is identifying the needs and preferences for that individual. They are working on that individual's behalf. They are an extension of that individual. And so they can help with the different things. You know, there's a lot of things that we don't do a great job of educating the society on. What are the best things to start preparing for when you do start reaching your golden years? Things like financial planning, eliminating some of the misconceptions, things like Medicare providing long-term care insurance. And so these people can help with the financial planning aspects, getting savings accounts in place, determining where the right retirement location is. The other things that people often aren't aware that need to start getting into place are things like advanced directives or living wills, some of these different things, instructions on what to do if you become incapacitated or you do pass away. Healthy eating habits, of course, which I know there's people in here passionate about that. One big thing that we notice when people move in with us is the lack of interest, or maybe not even the lack of interest, but the lack of access to satisfy their interest. And so we try to do a number of things. We're at Meadowlark there for programming, for access to activities, for social gatherings, for to increase mental stamina, whatever the case may be. But we've noticed that we, the industry, the long-term care industry, has noticed that those sedentary lifestyles can really actually have huge negative implications on medical thing, medical things associated with that person's well-being. And so and so that's one thing that we strongly encourage. And we even have people in place, and this is happening all over the country, that's their job. They're supposed to identify where there's gaps, you know, in a person's life and try to help them get resources in order to do that, something that we've not done a great job of before the last decade or so. So those things needing to be in place before these groups that I'm talking about can be able to take care of you. Most importantly, though, and this is where I want to move on from some of the things that are going on in the industry, there is a concept, and this concept of culture change that is extremely important, in my opinion, and it's just that, it's the most important idea for long-term care that exists right now. It's not just something that we've adopted here. It's gaining widespread adoption, and it's this idea, we call it a circle of wellness. And it's a philosophy that says that we're all in the center of our own circle of wellness, and surrounding us and in that circle are constructs or pillars or whatever you want to call them. And in those pillars, in theory, all or a combination or one of those would have to be satisfied or fulfilled at some capacity in order for you to be well, for you to consider yourself well. And so it may be that your constructs are that you have certain needs in the areas of physical or spiritual or social or mental or financial or intellectual or whatever the case may be. It may be for another person that only two or three of those exist, and theirs include occupational or stewardship, you know, the need to be able to give back. And so operating on this more holistic philosophy is what we want to try to get to. And not just in theory, not just treating it as a philosophy, but even in the medical world, operating by this philosophy. So this is why you see more physicians referring out to chiropractors or to massage therapists and so on and so forth, is so that they can try to help you in a way that is from a more holistic style of care and not just meeting your clinical needs. But really it goes back to what I mentioned earlier of how do we care for our elderly in a more respectful way, recognizing that they're the ones with the wisdom, they're our professors, they're our teachers, they are our mentors, and treating them in a way that they really deserve to be treated. And so that's kind of the main thing that's going on right now. That's one of our focuses at Meadowlark Hills. I went to a conference a few weeks back, and it's called the Pioneer Conference. And it was actually really encouraging because I threw out a stat earlier that 95% of the industry, of the long-term care industry, is still in the dark ages, so to speak. So when you go to their nursing home, you still walk down a hallway that's tile floored with the fluorescent lighting and the white walls and no artwork and people waiting out in the lobbies on something. And so it was nice to see that so many people are recognizing how we need to treat our elderly and then making the necessary changes in their life and in their world and in their organization in order to do that in a more respectful manner. So there's a lot more that goes on with that, but that's essentially what I wanted to address. And when we do this, we find actually that when we care for somebody and approach them in a way that meets their own preferences or their own individual needs from an individual individualized plan, we see higher quality of life. And in some cases, we see longevity in their lives. We see them able to live longer, happier, healthier, fulfilled lives. We see more satisfaction. We see happiness because they feel like they're valued and they still have purpose and the people and that they're needed. And so that's what we're trying to do at Meadowlark Hills. We have a long way to go. The industry has a long way to go. We've made drastic improvements, like I said, in the last decade on this. But what I'd like to do is, with all that in mind, from a person-centered care, from a person-first sort of direction and way of giving care, I want to read back over that scenario, but from the perspective of an individual still has some level of dementia, but from somebody who's providing person-centered care. And let me let you kind of get an indication as to how it's different. I love to sleep in. Let the early bird get the worm, I say. But I'm usually awake by 9:30. It never fails, not long after I open my eyes, Mary is peeking her head in my bedroom door saying, "Oh, it's a good one today." She turns on my bedside lamp and brings me a glass of orange juice, my medicine, and the funny papers. We both like Family Circus. She says the little boy reminds her of her son, and he reminds me of my son, too. She goes in my closet and asks if it is a red day or a green day, and she helps me decide what color shirt to wear. I like to dress myself, and Mary is very patient with me and is right there to help if I need her help. Then she turns to me and says, "Ready?" And I say, "Ready." Then she opens my drapes and takes me to the windowsill to water my plants. Last week, one of them bloomed, and she asked me if she could bring one of the other girls in to see it. She did, and I was so proud. I can't remember her name, but that girl sometimes stops by in the afternoon to say hi now and tells me about her garden, too. She takes me to the dining room. Since I am a late riser, the dining room is not too busy. Mary asked if I'd like some cereal or some scrambled eggs. When I choose eggs, she always remembers to bring me ketchup for them. Yesterday, I got some ketchup on my shirt, and I was pretty frustrated about it. But Mary squatted down and showed me a little brown spot on her shirt. "Coffee," she said and smiled. "Happens to the best of us." Then Mary says she has some other people to help, but she'll be around if I need her. I don't know a lot of people, but I figure if Mary is talking to them, they must be all right. I finish my breakfast, and then just like in my room, Mary says, "Ready?" And I sometimes say, "Ready," and want to go back to my room. But other times, I just want to sit there at the table or go outside or go for a walk, and Mary might pour me a little more coffee or some for herself. Mary's a good friend. So you can see how this delivery of care and how really caring for someone and loving that person as opposed to just working for them makes a huge impact. We in the industry, and really all of us, need to encourage each other, need to encourage those that have, that are doing this type of care every day, that are caring for their own loved ones and trying to help them make decisions on their long-term care, need to really support a culture that respects and reveres our elders as the trailblazers that they are. And I don't know about you, but the last scenario that I read is how I would want to be treated in my golden years, and it is certainly how our elders deserve to be treated right now. So I would encourage you to learn more about this, ask questions if you need to. I've got resources and things that you can get, but we're really working on this. We're trying to adopt this sort of philosophy and figure out ways to implement it, not just in certain levels of care, but all levels of care, long-term care, both independent living, assisted living, long-term care in hospitals, in the primary care world, and there's a lot of literature and research out there about it that we can look at. So, what's the format? Can I try to answer any questions or have some discussion around some of this? Yes.
Hi, Stacy Brofman. Excuse my croaky voice. I'm hoping it's done by next Saturday. As a person who works in the healthcare profession, what I would like to say, one, is I think what really needs to be brought in as well when we talk about patient-centered care is their families and to educate them that death is a natural process and that it's okay to be with somebody as they get older and to be with them and that we don't have to necessarily institutionalize mm-hmm. our elderly when it comes to that part. And we have to put personalization ahead of profits if you want to get that scenario that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. And that scenario you were talking about includes at least a certified medication aid because they handed out medications. And you're talking about somebody that spent at least an hour just that morning, not including a bath with that person. And to adequately do that, you're talking about a patient ratio of maybe five patients or residents mm-hmm. to that one person. And I would like to challenge any facility to ever have that sort of ratio to give that kind of care. And because I'd like for you to tell me, what is your nurse aide to resident ratio and nurse to resident ratio in your total sure. care household?
Sure. In total care? You said total care? In total care right now, we have some households that have a different amount of residents in them. So most of our houses have around 20, and usually those have, we're running at a ratio right now of all staff of about 4.5. So we have in one household, I'll just do it like that. We would have a nurse. We would have either two med aides or one med aide and two CNAs. And then we also have in our households, we have what we call homemakers. And most of our households don't do all of the cooking yet within the household. They can do breakfast and they can do warmings and things like that. But our main kitchen will do a lot of the preparing and then bring it. But we do have a person there that serves, you know, that does the servings, that does the drinks, that gets refills, that will do the cooking of the breakfast and so on and so forth. There's other households that that don't have as many residents. In fact, we have one household that has 13 residents. So we always have one nurse, and then we have, in the daytime, we typically have three aides, and at least one of those is a med aide, but then in the nighttime, we would have one nurse and one aide in that household. Yes.
Okay. pardon me. I got a croaky voice, too. Jim Chanteau, and I live at sure. Meadowlark in independent living, mm-hmm. but I want to talk about my mother, who lived in a healthcare household, a Roten house. I think it was wonderful for her to be there. I think she gained at least 3 additional years of life. If she hadn't have been, she hadn't have moved, she would have stayed back in Phoenix without any care at all, I think, and that would have been the end of her. But what I observed during the time she was there, well, that story you told was not at all atypical for what she experienced. The problem was Mary kept changing. And during the time she was there, there were probably 6 Marys. Mm-hmm. And if you know, she was only there 3 years. So the rate of turnover of caretakers, I think, is a major issue. And I understand the problem of expenses and people move, especially in this community. Yeah. But I think that seriously affects the care that elderly get. And if it's a different Mary every 6 months, that's not a good thing.
Yeah. That's an extremely valuable point. Our turnover rate has decreased in the past year. We're right now in the upper in the low 50s, upper 40s, like 49, 51-ish. We'd like to get down to around 35. We feel like with this community that would be acceptable because we see a lot of our turnover in our college age CNAs and CMAs. But no doubt about it, there's really no excuse. Meadowlark has experienced a turnover in leadership in the past few years, which we all know that can affect. It can have drastic effects on that sort of thing. So we're trying to do things to foster more teamwork and collaboration, to be more of mentor leaders instead of dictators. We are trying to evaluate whether or not, trying to be more competitive in our wage structure, because we know that plays a huge part in turnover as well. And what'd you say your last name was? Chantel, your mother is Helen. Okay, beautiful lady. I remember Helen very well. But that's a really valuable point. It's something that we work on literally every single day to try to get better at leadership and to evaluate our business practices so that we remain competitive in the industry. So it's decreased in the past year, but we're not where we want to be yet, certainly.
I'm Ann Cowan.
Yeah.
I spent my last 10 years as a physical therapist overseeing therapy in 20 different nursing homes throughout Kansas, so I saw a lot. But the turnover in aides, I agree with Jim, was a huge problem, and it was mostly due, first of all, it's very hard work that they're doing. And if they find a place that will pay them 10 or 15 cents more an hour, they are going to leave. So it was constant turnover. When I went into a nursing home and found aides that had been there for 10, 15 years, I knew that that was going to be a good place. My second comment is, unfortunately, this all is a business. It's an industry, and it's almost always, and I know Meadowlark is not profit-making, but most nursing homes are profit-making, and even forgetting the reimbursement from Medicaid levels, you know, that's a problem because you're dealing with industries that are going to make as much profit as they can.
Yeah, thank you for that. We do have a few of our staff members, and I can think of them in my head right now that have been there for over 25 and 30 years. And what I notice is that, you know, what you make for a living is very important to us all, and I get that you want to be able to live a certain lifestyle. What I have found and seen is that those that have been with us for so long, they're on a different playing field of how they approach the people that they care for. You can truly tell that they love those people. It's not them getting up to work, you know, getting up from bed every morning and like, oh, I got to go to work today. It's going to care for people that they actually truly love. So I know finances, you know, we have to address that. We have to be competitive. We have to keep good people. But we also are trying to train people and get them to adopt our culture in such a way that it lends to them caring for them not to earn a paycheck, but caring for them because they love that person and they're invested in their well-being.
So. Okay. Hi, Garrett. Thanks for a good, straightforward talk. My area of expertise, if it can be called that, is I'm old. And but I also have spent the last 40 years plus part-time to full-time working in the field of reminiscence writing. And I actually come up to Meadowlark a couple, three times a month and have a wonderful class up there. They're wonderful. I don't know if I am. But and you've touched on in your talk about revering the elderly. And my experience is we don't get revered for nothing. You know, we have to do something. And I also come out of a generation which my parents always used to say, Charlie, make yourself useful. Get up and wash the dishes or slop the hogs or something. And so what I'm trying to come at is the idea of what can you do, what do you think you can do at Meadowlark, which is a wonderful place, really, to have people have the feeling that they're still making themselves useful. And for me particularly, it's through reminiscence and actually putting forth some of that wisdom that they have. And I'll just close with a couple of little things, or one about my dear wife's mother. She was not she was in a nursing home. It was okay, but this was, 20 years ago, and it was just a country nursing home. And she was called a roamer. The staff, I don't know if you know that term, R-O-A-M-E-R, roamer. It was an informal slang term that the staff used for patients or people who were inmates, whatever you want to call them, residents of a nursing home who roamed. They wouldn't stay in their rooms. They would get up. And Lois, Yoon's wonderful, wonderful mother, who was 92 at the time, she would get up and try to go help other people make their beds or tidy up their rooms and so on. And she was just a damn nuisance, I think, to the staff, but it was lovable. And Lois always made herself useful. When she would come down to visit us from her farm up in Clay Center, first thing she did was take off her coat, put on her apron, and go to work. And that was the meaning of her life. And so you talk about cultural change. For a lot of old people, you know, that transition from being a caregiver to being a care receiver is difficult. Maybe you could comment.
Sure, I'd love to. Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, and for me, that's an easy one. In healthcare, that's how it's always been. I mean, you tell people how to do stuff in the long-term care in the nursing homes, right? And so there's little things that we do on a daily basis, and anybody that's adopted this sort of person-centered care, we have our residents make, you know, that. Now, I should start off by saying we're governed by a pretty strict set of regulatory laws in nursing. And so we try to come up with ways in which we maintain our integrity, we comply with those laws, but while we can deliver this type of care that I'm talking about. And so we've got our residents involved in, they're the ones in their households coming up with their what they're doing every day, the daily activities calendar, as most people know it. The things about letting them make all of their own decisions related to their schedule, their daily schedule, when they want to wake up, when they want to go to bed, and that sort of thing. And we find that that gives people a sense of ownership and a sense of value. Additionally, though, we try to think outside the box a little bit. And we've got, within our households, we've got leadership teams, and typically those consist of staff members from the varying levels of, nurses and aides and so forth, managers. But we try to encourage resident participation in that too. And so you've got residents now that are conducting interviews, that are going to the interviews for staff. You've got residents that are now have involvement in planning the menu for the month, the menu that is reoccurring. But additionally, coming up with ways in which they could maybe have what we call now a short order menu list. So those that like to eat maybe 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon, having items on hand all the time where they can, and so they make those decisions. And so I find that's what gives our residents the greatest sense of ownership, is being able to still make decisions. And you mentioned your mother-in-law that would go around and make the beds and the different things like that, and we encourage that. Not because we need, you know, the assistance and our staff, you know, can't get to it, but because they do find huge value in it. If you come into Meadowlark, it would not be uncommon from time to time for you to walk into a kitchen in a household and see a resident in there with a hairnet on, you know, with gloves on and cranking away on a cake mix or something like that. And then one final thought on that is, you mentioned you're a reminiscence writer and you're familiar with Life Bio. Okay, and we see huge value in the work that you do and your colleagues, because that is a huge area of expression, right? And they can have a residents get a huge sense of gratitude when they have somebody to tell their story to. And so there's this program that we struggle to get it off the ground. Maybe you'd be able to help us with that, but it's called Life Bio, and it is a way for individuals to tell their story in however manner they wish to tell it. And providing somebody to help them type that or help them get it into a booklet format or whatever the case may be. So thank you for that thought.
Yep, my name's Kathy Hedge.
Hi, Kathy.
Thank you. I have two comments. One is, I find a very interesting parallel to what happened in education. I'm a career teacher. And initially when I started out, the concept was, well, I taught the class. They just chose not to learn it. Or, you know, it's on the student's responsibility to get everything because I presented it. Well, it's that warehousing point of view. Mm-hmm. And very gradually it's become every child has the right to learn, and I need to figure out how to do it. Mm-hmm. So it's the kind of transition there that I see you speaking about in elder care. But I think the biggest thing that stands in our way is a culture shift that we must have, and that is, maybe the one thing the baby boomers will actually accomplish of all the things we thought we were going to accomplish is that when we get to elder care, we're still a big financial demographic. And if we're cranky enough to say, look, I am somebody. I have a mind. Stop putting out on the airwaves, on the commercials, and on movies these stereotypes of horrible stereotypes of someone being incompetent. Even if, I don't know if any of you saw the last Ice Age movie, but it was one of the most disgusting things I'd ever seen in the depiction of the elderly. That, we're still allowing that in our culture to happen. Mm-hmm. But whereas we go through and say other things should not be, those stereotypes shouldn't be out there, but we're still letting that happen to our elderly. And I'm hoping maybe the baby boomers will use their spending power to say, I'm not going to buy and support places that treat our elderly in that demeaning fashion.
Yeah, great point. And I just have one follow-up comment, and that is that so it's more about the culture shift in society in general, not just the long-term care industry. And one thing that is related, when we care for those individuals who may have some, might have dementia or some form of dementia, a lot of people just assume that they lose their intellect, they lose their intelligence, when in reality, some of their effects may just be that they are losing the ability to recall long-term memory or short-term memory things, or they might have something that impedes their speech a little bit. But it is that type of thing where we see that people, because somebody is reaching their elderly years or is within them, somehow think that they've lost their ability to think or their lost their wisdom that they've gained with all these life experiences that they've had. So 100% agree. She should be your next speaker. That's who you should have up here. Linda.
Hi, Linda Krieger. Hi, Garrett.
Hi.
I'm a nurse practitioner, and I want to just speak briefly about the PACE program, because my first job as a nurse practitioner was in East Boston, and it was a PACE demonstration site. And that was a really beautiful program for elders, because we really were an extension of the family. Family members were committed to keeping their elder at home. And we had a day center so the person could come in, or we would pick up their elderly mother, bring them to our center. I was part of a physician, and I worked a clinic there. So they would literally come to the center, have breakfast, activities. We had aides. They'd get their showers there, their medications. Mm-hmm. They'd be seen by me or their physician for their health care. Physical therapy worked with us. Bingo in the afternoon. What I loved about that program is if my schedule was slow, I could go call bingo in the afternoon. And then they would either be brought back home at 5 o'clock so that the daughter could again care for them in the evening. But these people were all certified as nursing home level of care and were allowed to live in the community with the help of this PACE program. It was a beautiful program. The trouble was, if you weren't on Medicaid, you really couldn't afford privately to belong to that program. There is a PACE program in Topeka, Midland Health, and also one in Wichita. But the trouble with health care, I agree with Stacy, staffing ratios are huge when it comes to turnover, because you can only work that hard for so long. And everybody wants health care, but nobody wants to pay for it. And that's kind of the situation we're in now.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
I agree. Pat or Harriet,
Harriet Yonke. I just happened to visit with a nursing home administrator from Kentucky yesterday. But he was referring to his people as patients, and I kept wanting to say they're not patients, they're residents. And then a comment that I heard from one of our aides, I guess we were in the elevator or something. She said, this is the only place I've ever worked where I could get marked down for not visiting with a resident. Mm-hmm. I thought that was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And then why don't you tell them about the DREAM program?
Oh, sure. There's a...
Wait a minute. He wants to say something.
Oh,
I want to say
yes,
something personal about Garrett. You know how frustrating it is when your computer doesn't work? Well, we live in Middle Ark in an apartment on the third floor, and... I couldn't make the dang computer do what I wanted it to do. And I was downstairs, and I happened to meet Garrett, and I told him, because I was kind of desperate. And he said, well, I'll come on up and look at it. So he did. He came up, and he fiddled around with it a while, and pretty soon it was working. another thing about Garrett, I like to play chess, and And I don't know how he found out about it, but every once in a while we have a chess game. And he's pretty good. And the third thing is that he plays the piano. He'll go into living room and play around on the piano, and that's very enjoyable.
Thank you, Alan. Appreciate that. Well, let me comment on that dream program just real quick. We have a staff member that's been with us for over 13 years, and she's an amazing person. We sent her off to become, and it sounds kind of funny, but a certified dream manager. And it's a program that's it's being adopted just like these others. And what she does, and right now she's primarily doing it with our staff, but we're trying to figure out a way to expand this to residents as we can. But it's a employee benefit right now. And it's like you walk in, and I haven't gone through her program yet, but I've touched on it. And she says, "What is your dream?" And mine was to, you know, own a some, you know, 50 acre somewhere with at least two ponds and three horses. And so, but anyway, it can be any type of dream of that. Maybe a nurse aide wants to become a nurse. And so she will help guide you through the process of how you make those decisions and then how you work through those to accomplish those dreams.
I'm going to give Pat Embers the last word. She seems eager to say something.
Yes. Yes, Pat.
Talk about the program that I'm doing there, which is the Move with Balance program that some of you know about. But I know the Wellness Fair is coming up this Thursday, and that's open to the public,
yes.
Right? Could you please explain that a little
sure.
bit?
Sure. Thank you for bringing that up. We're going to have a Wellness Fair at Meadowlark Hills. It's going to be this Thursday. It's come in as you please and go as you please from 1:30 to 5 p.m. It's in our community building, so you can enter on the southeast main side of campus there. And we're going to have, I was talking to Pat, I think like 26 booths now. And it's individuals it's healthcare professionals from within our own organization or those that we partner with in some way, like Pat's group, in order to deliver services on our campus for our residents or in their own facilities in which we provide our resident access with. And the whole idea of the Wellness Fair, not just to educate people on what is going on and what we're doing, but it's the culmination of the initiatives and the efforts that we've taken in the last year and a half or so to satisfy those pillars of wellness. So what you're going to see when you come there is that on the table for each of the vendors, if you will, their name tag, their table thing, will have which pillars we believe that they could satisfy for an individual. So it's going to be a really cool time. There will be refreshments. There will be opportunity for prizes and things like that. So thank you very much for this opportunity. Great to meet all of you.
Thanks very much, Garrett. We're late, but let's sing our last song. Stand As You Are Able, Gray Hymnal number 4. Okay, I'm sorry to keep you a few minutes beyond deadline. Here's a very short final reading from Rabindranath Tagore. The same stream of life that runs through my veins night and day runs through the world and dances in rhythmic measures. It is the same life that shoots in joy through the dust of the earth in numberless blades of grass and breaks into tumultuous waves of leaves and flowers. It is the same life that is rocked in the ocean cradle of birth and of death and ebb and flow. I feel my limbs are made glorious by the touch of this world of life, and my pride is from the life throb of ages dancing in my blood this moment. Go in peace and let's have coffee.